Everybody, thanks for choosing the weird presentation. I think compared to the other ones. Thanks for taking the chance. I called my presentation Vice Regents and Voles. John Wesley doesn't actually mention voles, but I needed the alliteration, and vampire bats didn't quite have the same effect. But I'm going to be talking about Wesley's anthropology, which actually came up a lot at the last session if you were in this room. And the implications for how we as Christians might think about animal ethics. So I'd like to start off with a question. Does anyone know the names of John Wesley's horses? Anyone?
George was a ghost in his house, but I don't know him.
I appreciate you taking the chance. It was a trick question. Unfortunately, nobody actually knows the names. But even though Wesley scholars have not deduced this fact yet, it is clear that John Wesley fostered a very close relationship with these horses. He traveled something around 400,000 kilometers on these beasts, which is about the same distance it takes to travel from here to Vancouver, 91 times. So he probably spent more time with his horses than any other creature on earth, including people. So his spirituality was not separated from his relationship with these creatures. In a 1746 journal entry, he interestingly chronicles a time when he prays for his lame horse. The horse is miraculously healed, and that enables him to continue his journey. He also wrote that all itinerant Methodist preachers should be merciful to their beast, not only riding moderately, but see with their own eyes that their horse be rubbed, fed, and bedded. And his interest in animals was not limited to the common horse, but also to more exotic creatures as well. Another journal entry in 1776, so quite an elderly man at this point in his life, it describes a curious visit that he and a friend took to the Tower of London Zoo. And the reason they went to the zoo was his friend could play the flute, and John Wesley wanted to see how the lion would react to this flute being played. That's why they went to the zoo. A lot of people know about his scientific interests, and that included zoology, the study of animals. It's a funny little painting of John Wesley on a horse. I think the proportions are a little off, but so at the age of 60, he published a two-volume book called A Compendium of Natural Philosophy, being a survey of the wisdom of God in the creation. So I flipped through an edition from 1809. And discovered sections about mules, spider flies, ants, beavers, moths, shellfish, insect diseases, and the regeneration of earthworms, which incidentally is a topic that my 4-year-old son is also very interested in these days. And then for 20 years, so he starts it when he's 60, he publishes it, and when he for 20 years, until he's 80 years old, he keeps adding to it and refining it until it becomes a 3-volume work. And as you can see from this edition, was being used decades after his death in science classrooms. So, of course, this keen interest in animals shaped and was shaped by Wesley's theological convictions. And those are perhaps best exhibited in his 1781 sermon entitled The General Deliverance, in which he develops an eschatological vision in which not only human beings, but all non-human animals will receive redemption and experience a time without death, sorrow, or crying, echoing the language of Revelation 21. So others have focused on Wesley's eschatology and its relationship to animals and animal theology, including actually Professor James Pedler. He wrote an article in the Canadian American Theological Review. It's pretty interesting. So while I will mention this sermon a few times today, for the sake of this presentation, I'm more interested in how Wesley was thinking about humans, his theological anthropology, rather than his eschatology. So my interest in this topic of Wesley's understanding of human beings, which if you're in the last session in this room, you got a bit of a spoiler. It began during a reading and research course I took with Professor Victor Shepherd at Wycliffe College. And maybe some of you recognize this book if you ever went to a seminary and did a Wesley class. And so Professor Shepherd had me read a large number of these sermons from John Wesley. And during this, drink at the fire hose, just sitting reading sermons, actually, most of them at night as I was working a night shift at Salvation Army shelter, reading John Wesley. And something that kept coming up to me was this phrase, over and over, the image of God. The image of God. And sure enough, upon some further digging, I discovered that excluding his explanatory notes on the Bible, Wesley mentions the phrase the image of God over 220 times in his written works. Indeed, it's such an important part of his whole kind of theological system that Young Tak Kim describes his soteriology as fundamentally being the restoration of the image of God. And likewise, Albert Outler, the leading Methodist theologian, said that the restoration of the Imago Dei is the axial theme of Wesley's soteriology. So just one example of that. In one of Wesley's sermons called The Means of Grace, 1746, he reminds his audience that, quote, ye are saved from your sins, from the guilt and power thereof. Ye are restored to the favor and image of God. So in that quote, Wesley is comfortable speaking about forgiveness from guilt, empowerment over sin, alongside being restored to the image of God, which reveals that all of these kind of encompass how he understands salvation. So how did Wesley actually understand the image of God to be reflected by humanity? What did that familiar phrase mean to him? And what are those of us that have received salvation? What are we being restored to? Well, one way of categorizing Wesley's thought on this theme is to take a cue from his 1760 sermon entitled The New Birth, in which he classifies three facets of the image of God, which are the natural, the moral, and the political image. So excuse my rudimentary little graphic here. So in that sermon, he describes the natural image of God in humanity as a picture of God's own immortality. Humans are spiritual beings endued with understanding, freedom of will, and various affections. 21 years later, in a 1781 sermon called The End of Christ's Coming, he more particularly describes this natural image as containing, again, understanding, will, and liberty. And it's a consistent understanding of Wesley's, for even I found a sermon when he was 27 years old in 1730. Again, he speaks about the image of God as including the natural image, which is understanding, will, and liberty. It's also kind of curious that Wesley recognized in that sermon that non-human animals have also been given understanding, will, and liberty. And in a sense, they too reflect the natural image of God. However, humans reflect this natural image more strongly and are further differentiated by the other branches on my tree here. But it's just curious that he was kind of willing to concede that point, that in some way animals reflect some form of the image of God. And secondly, well, it's kind of blocked, unfortunately. But secondly, and with greater length, Wesley speaks of human beings made in God's moral image. And this is what I believe her name is Dr. Wong was speaking about in the last session quite a bit. So for Wesley, this aspect, thanks, Ben, of the Imago Dei, it chiefly encompasses how humans are made in God's image. The moral image of God means that like God, quote, man at his creation was full of love. And likewise, just as God is full of justice, mercy, and truth, and spotless purity, so was humanity. So for Wesley, it is these features of humanity that enable God in Genesis 1:31 to joyously proclaim us as being very good. And while humans continue to retain and reflect the natural and political images of God after the fall, although in a heavily distorted way, which we'll soon talk about, for Wesley, it is impossible for humans to truly reflect the moral image of God apart from a restored relationship with him. In Wesley's understanding, the moral image is, in the words of Theodore Runyon, most totally effaced. Another theologian, Kenneth Collins, goes further, and he describes the moral image of God as being totally lost due to the fall, in Wesley's understanding. So for this reason, it is the restoration of the moral image of God that Wesley is most interested in expanding upon when he sketches out his vision of salvation. But for the sake of this presentation, exploring animal ethics and Wesley, it's his understanding of the political image that is most relevant for us this afternoon. So in his sermon, The New Birth, he describes God's gift of his political image to humanity as making us the governor of this lower world, having dominion. And to quote his 1781 sermon that I mentioned earlier, The General Deliverance, he elaborates on this role, and he says that man was God's vice-regent upon the earth, the prince and governor of this lower world, and all the blessings of God flowed through him to the inferior creatures. Man was the channel of conveyance between his creator and the whole brute creation. So as taught in the Genesis creation accounts, reflected many times in the Psalms, Wesley affirms that humans are to be benevolent stewards and caretakers for the rest of creation. And reiterating this relational emphasis that kind of runs through all of Wesley's theology, Kenneth Collins notes that the political image of God shows that humans are not only inexplicably connected to God, but also to nature itself and other creatures. And I came across a blog post that Professor Pedler wrote talking about the image of God and the mission of God. And he also notes that benevolence is key in understanding this political image of God. And he says that unless humans reflect God's love in their exercise of dominion, they are not truly reflecting the political image of God. Theodore Runyon, again, he writes that humans only reflect the political image of God insofar as the benevolence of God is reflected in human actions towards the rest of creation. And lastly, Kenneth Collins, he also notes that to exercise the political image of God for Wesley means that humanity cannot treat other creatures in a way that God would not. That's a key point for my presentation. Humanity cannot treat other creatures in a way that God would not if we want to reflect the political image of God. But clearly, in both Wesley's century and our own, more often than not, we do not act with benevolence towards our fellow creatures. While we have retained our political image and we still exercise dominion over the creation, we do not do this in reflection of God's benevolence and as conduits of God's grace. I don't think that's too controversial of a statement. Rather, in a warped desire to enforce our power and exploit the rest of creation, or perhaps in selfish ignorance, obliviousness, humanity by and large has disregarded animal life as bearing intrinsic value other than that which benefits ourselves, right? So the warping of our political image has also affected the rest of the planet and not merely our own species. And Wesley recognized this. He writes that Adam threw not only himself, but likewise the whole creation into disorder, misery, and death. And in the last session, Dr. Wong was talking about, you know, earthquakes and natural disasters even being caused in some sense by the fall of humanity. So as Wesley wrote in that same 1781 sermon, how true then is that word? God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. But how far is this from being the present case? So Wesley's saying that in 1781. You know, how much more so in 2024? And if you'll allow me to get personal for a moment, you don't have to raise your hands, but think about the date of your birth. Was it on 1970 or before? I won't make you raise your hands. But the reason I bring that up is that the 2022 Global Living Planet Index shows an average decrease of 69% in 32,000 monitored wildlife populations between the years 1970 and 2018. So to restate that, I know it's a lot of numbers coming at you. But so basically, for those of you that were born in 1970 or before, this means that in your lifetime, since the WWF began monitoring over 5,000 different species of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish, there is an average global decrease across these populations by 69%, which is pretty depressing. Even 2 months ago, a United Nations report came out that one in five migratory species of wild animals are threatened by extinction. It should also be emphasized that these population declines and threats of extinction are almost uniformly believed to be human caused. Overexploitation, habitat loss, excessive pollution are the major causes. So even if you were to reject the idea of human-caused climate change, it is undeniable that there is a biodiversity crisis happening on our planet that is caused by God's image bearers. Indeed, many biologists and other scientists are recognizing that we are living in a human-caused mass extinction event. So I think by any metric, we humans have utterly failed to even remotely reflect God's political image to our fellow creatures. We have not been God's benevolent conduits of grace, as John Wesley envisioned, in the way he described God's political image. I would take this even further and say that though, you know, we might not talk about it much in church, as human beings, we have sinned in this area. We have continually chosen to partner with the powers of sin and death, missing the mark of our God-given human vocation. Over and over, we have chosen to follow the snake rather than the lamb when it comes to creation stewardship. So this, I know it's a bit of a downer, but just bear with me here. This failure to reflect God's political image and live up to our divinely mandated human vocation was likely recognized, again, by Wesley some 250 years ago. So I'm going to quote another part of that sermon from 1781, and I hope you enjoy my shark clip art. Wesley contrasts carnivorous animals with humans, and he writes, "What a dreadful difference is there between what they, animals, suffer from their fellow brutes and what they suffer from the tyrant man. The lion, the tiger, or the shark gives them pain from mere necessity in order to prolong their own life and puts them out of their pain at once. But the human shark, without any such necessity, torments them of his free choice and perhaps continues their lingering pain till after months or years, death signs their release." The human shark, that image just sticks with me. I've also been watching Jaws lately, so that's another topic. So that last line from Wesley made me think about another group of animals whose population is actually going up, not down, and that, of course, is the animals that we eat. You know, every year, human beings slaughter somewhere between 80 to 90 billion birds and land animals for food, and this number is rising. As both the human population rises, the meat-eating population is also rising in densely populated and economically developing countries, such as India and China. Here's another graphic. So again, use that kind of arbitrary 1970 number. In 1970, humans killed around 11 billion chickens for food, whereas 2 years ago, in 2022, we killed over 75 billion. That orange line is the chicken consumption and slaughtering going way up. So the number is rising and the amount of animals being farmed is going up, which it's going up much more than a rise in population accounts for, which is interesting. So I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that John Wesley wants you to go vegan or you're a sinner because you ate the ham wrap at lunch. You have to give up your morning bacon. But I would like to briefly talk about contemporary farming and the moral challenges that this industry presents us in light of John Wesley's political image of God theology. So the rise in animals raised for human consumption has resulted in what is known in the industry as concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, another more commonly known as factory farms. So in Canada, between 1941 in 1921, so an 80-year period, the number of farms has gone down by 75% in 80 years in this country, while animal production has gone way up. So it's a global trend and not unique to our own region that there are fewer farms, but there are bigger farms. In the U.S., for example, around 90% of all eggs come from just 67 producers. 97 eggs come from 67 producers. So what this means practically is that chickens, turkeys, pigs, cows, sheep, these animals that we eat, they don't live lives as they used to, you know, in Old MacDonald Had a Farm or the kids' books or your grandparents' stories. Whereas at one time, chickens were able to actually move around a barnyard and live a fairly bird-like natural existence, the vast majority of chickens alive in 2024 will never see the sunlight, living in densely packed, artificially conditioned sheds, with about as much space to move as the area of this piece of paper. It's pretty surprising. So I grew up in Eastern Ontario, And our family actually hobby farmed numerous animals throughout my childhood. You know, my brother David, he's a big farmer. So we had some laying hens for eggs. And those birds would come in and out of a hen house. They'd jump up and down from a perch. They'd wander outside during the day. We had chickens for meat that we rotationally grazed under something called a chicken tractor, where you move it every few days. And the chickens, you know, they ate bugs, they ate grass, they felt the wind on their feathers. We had geese that wandered around all day, being brought in at night, until my dad forgot to bring them in one night or a little too late, but that's a different story. We had pigs that a big barnyard they had to slop around in and enjoy. We had cattle that we rotationally grazed for as much of the year as we could, and then they were put in a three-sided structure throughout the winter, and they're outside. But these creatures that my family tended to and ate, I'll add, they're the exception to the similar chickens, geese, pigs, and cattle on our planet in this century. It is estimated that 90% of farm creatures around the world and 99% of creatures in the United States are kept in factory farms, where numerous practices perpetuate the suffering of animals. One such practice, don't worry, it's not too graphic. One such practice in pig farming around the world is the use of gestation crates. So here on the left, this is a crate or a cage, a little wider and only slightly longer than a pregnant pig's body, you can see, in which she will remain for the 4 months of its pregnancy. The pig won't be able to turn around at all during this time. When the pig gives birth, it will be moved to a farrowing crate, this other image here on the right, where piglets will be able to nurse, but the mother will be unable to tend to her offspring, which will be taken from her around 3 to 4 weeks later. And then the process begins again and again. And the pig ends up kind of living its life in one of these crates for 3 to 4 years until its productivity goes down and it's slaughtered and another young sow is brought in. So my older brother, he was in a 4-H pig club when I was a kid. So we had a pig running around. And I know that pigs are smart. In fact, many studies have shown that pigs are actually smarter than dogs. And they're very similar to dogs. And in the last 15 to 20 years, this caging practice has been rightly recognized as being, you know, rather cruel and inhumane. And it's been banned or greatly reduced in the UK, New Zealand, the European Union, and 9 US states. Whereas in Canada, in 2014, the National Farm Animal Care Council banned the purchase of new gestation crates, and they gave their farmers 10 years to accommodate, but actually, which would make it 2024. But they recently released that they're going to give their farmers another 5 years to change. And it's also worth noting that this code is not legally binding or enforceable.
Oh,
so this is just one example of a cruel practice rampantly used in contemporary farming. If we had more time and if your stomachs could take it, we could talk about battery cages for eggs, laying hens, such as on the left, where can't actually stretch their wings, much less jump around. We could talk about the 6.5 billion male chicks that are hatched only to be shredded alive in industrial grinders because they aren't profitable. We could talk about the force feedings of ducks for foie de gras, the veal industry, and many others. But my point in bringing this up is a simple one, that I think, and again, I don't think it's that controversial, maybe you disagree, but I think that these practices that I've described are a far cry from Wesley's understanding of how human beings were intended to represent God's benevolent political image to our fellow creatures. Instead of benevolent dominion over our fellow sentient creatures, you know, capable of suffering and joy, we treat them more like, to quote a book from 1964 by Ruth Harrison, we treat them like animal machines. You know, they take in the grain and they put out the pork or whatever. We treat them like protein units or even like raw materials, wood or metal. So my point in this presentation, I'll be the first to say they haven't been all that profound or even original. But my main point is to encourage us, myself included, to ask, you know, the way that we humans currently relate to other animals, is it reflecting God's image the way that John Wesley understood it? Are we truly acting with benevolence as God's vice regents, being conduits of his grace to our fellow creatures? And I've tried to show that that's clearly not the case, whether you're looking at the biodiversity crisis or much of farming in our century. So if for Wesley, salvation is a restoration to bearing God's image, should we not consider how our own salvation might tie into these questions? Is not our relationship to our fellow creatures a matter of discipleship, even a way that we might grow in holiness? And if bearing dominion over other creatures is a fundamental part of our God-ordained human status, shouldn't we take this issue very seriously, since ultimately we're being held accountable by our mutual creator? And it seems to be something that God clearly cares about, right? The beginning of the book, Genesis 1. So I'm just about to wrap up here. So the leading theologian thinking about some of these questions is actually a Methodist. His name is David Clough, I think you say his name. He's from the UK. And I should add that I don't think it's an accident that he is a Methodist and is asking some of these questions based on even some of the teachings you've seen here today that John Wesley had about animals and animal salvation even. So he concludes a recent article, David Clough, on John Wesley and animal welfare in the following way, which I think is worth quoting in full, and that'll be the end of my presentation. So he writes, John Wesley believed that Christian faith required recognizing that animals were the beloved creatures of God, recipients alongside humans of God's grace in creation, providence, and redemption. He believed that this had practical implications for how Christians should treat animals. These beliefs were widely shared by Wesley's Methodist contemporaries and by Methodists in the early 19th century. Since Wesley's time, human cruelty towards animals has increased in scale, particularly through the rapid expansion of novel industrial farming methods. All Christians, and especially those belonging to churches with Wesleyan origins, have reason to take seriously the implications of Wesley's animal theology and ethics. So, on that note, thank you for your time. Thanks for coming.